Welcome to History Class After Hours. I'm Joseph Barron. Joining me is Brian.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm here again.
He's here again. Hopefully people can hear him.
Yeah, apparently I can't be heard, so either our mics aren't working or I'm just not loud enough. So
we shall see.
Yeah.
So continuing our discussion on presidential campaigns, today we are going to talk about three people who have run for president that are kind of unique, per se.
That's a word.
They're interesting. They're interesting folks.
All right.
First guy's name is William Wirt.
Huh.
He was born in Bladensburg, Maryland, to a German mother, Henrietta, and a Swiss-German father, Jacob.
Or would it pronounce...
Wirt?
Would it be like Jacob? Because it's...
It would be Jacob. Yep.
Yeah.
Wirt. Not Wirt. Wirt. But both of his parents die before he's eight. And his uncle becomes his guardian. Jasper. Wirt. Between his 7th and 11th birthday, Wirt went on to several classical schools. And finally, one kept by Reverend James Hunt in Montgomery County, where he received, over the course of 4 years, the major part of his education. For 2 years, he boarded with Hunt, in whose library he spent much of his time reading with a keen and indiscriminate appetite. In his 15th year, the school was disbanded. Oh. Man, this guy can't catch a break.
Yeah.
And his inheritance was all gone.
Well, that's not good.
Nope. Ninian Edwards, who was later governor of Illinois, had been Wirt's schoolmate. And Edwards' father, Benjamin Edwards, later a member of Congress from Maryland, thought Wirt had more than ordinary natural ability and invited him to reside with his family as tutor to Ninian and two nephews, offering him also to use the library for his own studies.
That's what's worth it for him.
Worth it for Wirt?
Yeah, big library.
Wirt accepted the offer and stayed 20 months, teaching, pursuing his own classical and historical studies, writing, and preparing for the bar. Look at that. And he becomes a lawyer, and then eventually the Attorney General of the United States.
Oh, wow.
Good for him.
Yeah.
After leaving his position as Attorney General, Wirt settled in Baltimore, Maryland. He became a candidate for president in 1832, nominated by the Anti-Masonic Party.
Are those the ones who are just against the Masons?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, there was...
That's like their only standpoint?
Pretty much, yeah. All right. The party held its first ever national nominating convention in U.S. history on September 11th, 1830, in Philadelphia, establishing the tradition. The date was chosen to commemorate the fourth anniversary of the Morgan Affair. However, no candidate was agreed upon. The Morgan Affair, also known as the Morgan Affair of 1826, refers to a controversial incident involving the disappearance of William Morgan and the subsequent uproar and conspiracy theories surrounding his fate. William Morgan was a Freemason who had become disillusioned with the Masonic order, and he decided to publish a book revealing all his secret, all the secrets.
Ah.
Because it's a very secretive order.
Yeah. I mean, are they that secretive anymore?
I believe so.
Okay.
I believe it's still pretty tight-lipped. Morgan's intention to publish the book titled Illustrations of Masonry angered many Freemasons who considered the exposure of their rituals and practices a breach of loyalty. On September 11th, 1826, Morgan was arrested for an alleged debt, but he was released the next day. However, he mysteriously disappeared shortly after his release, and his disappearance led to widespread speculation and accusations. Many believed that Morgan was kidnapped and murdered by Masons seeking to prevent the publication of the book. This event triggered a wave of anti-Masonic sentiment and public outrage, and it led to the formation of the Anti-Masonic Party, which became the first third party in U.S. history.
Oh, wow. Even before, like, the populists and
mm-hmm.
that stuff?
Yep. Okay. Morgan Fair had a significant impact on American politics and society, contributing to the decline of the Freemasons' influence and the rise of anti-Masonic sentiments during the early 19th century. The true circumstances of Morgan's disappearance remain unclear. Various theories, though, do surround the incident. So, yeah, Freemasons were very popular early American history. And because of that event, membership starts to decline significantly. But then when the Civil War happens, it increases significantly, like right before fighting begins.
All right.
Because guys start signing up for the Freemasons because they thought they would get
out of the draft.
Not out of the draft, but preferential treatment on the battlefield.
Okay.
Because Masons are supposed to take care of Masons no matter the situation. And you actually do have accounts where opposing people would see like a wounded person on the battlefield and see their Mason ring and give them the medical attention and stuff like that, that they typically wouldn't give Joe Schmo, who's just...
They're just hoping that there's
a
Mason out there.
Correct. Okay. Yep. Happened once at Gettysburg, I think I heard an account. Wow. So the actual nomination occurred a year later during the second convention in Baltimore. On April 28, 1831, Wirt became presidential candidate after the fifth ballot. Amos Elmaker became his running mate. Never heard of that man in my life. Wirt is the only person from Maryland to ever become a presidential candidate who won any electoral votes. That's kind of shocking.
Yeah. I'm surprised he won any electoral votes. That's the shocking part.
Here's the kicker. Wirt was actually a former Freemason. He had taken 2 degrees of Freemasonry in Jerusalem Lodge number 54 in Richmond, Virginia, becoming a fellow craft or a second degree Mason. Wirt wrote in his acceptance letter to the nominating convention that he found Freemasonry unobjectionable and that in his experience, many Masons were intelligent men of high and honorable character who would never choose Freemasonry above their duties of God and country. Not really sure where he's going here.
Yeah, that
doesn't.
I don't know what he's saying.
I don't know. Yeah, for as the presidential candidate for the anti-Freemason party, Where's he going here? Historian William Vaughn wrote, "Wirt was possibly the most reluctant and most unwilling presidential candidate ever." Maybe that's why. After being selected, Wirt started to regret his nomination and distance himself from actual campaigning. Maybe he was afraid of what happened to Morgan was going to happen to him.
Yeah, probably.
He admitted later, "In the canvass, I took no part, not even by writing private letters, which on the contrary, I refused to answer whenever such answers could be interpreted in the canvassing for office." So apparently people are asking questions. He's just ignoring them. And they still gave him the nomination. Private conversations, Wirt criticized Masonry for alleged intent to create international order ruled from Europe, but refused all anti-Masonic attempts to make his sentiments public.
Oh, man, if you tell Americans that they're trying to get Europe to rule, then...
Yeah, back then? Oh, yeah. He hoped for enthusiastic national support to an electoral alliance between anti-Masons and National Republicans that would then overpower the Jacksonian Democrats. When his expectations did not materialize, he wrote in frustration about his presidential aspiration, "It neither breaks my leg nor picks my pocket." In the election, Wirt carried Vermont with 7 electoral votes, becoming the first candidate of an organized third party to carry a state. And he remains once again the only presidential candidate to get any electoral votes from Maryland. When the Providence American newspaper suggested that Wirt could run again in 1836, he quickly declined. In 1833, Wirt became involved with his son-in-law in establishing a German immigrant colony in Florida.
Huh?
I need to check that out.
Yeah.
On lands that he bought but never inspected personally. It failed. Probably a swamp.
Yeah,
probably a swamp.
It's just in the Everglades. A ton of German people trying to survive.
What could go wrong? Wirt practiced law until his death. He fell sick on February 8th, 1834 in D.C., where he attended the proceedings of the Supreme Court. His biographer, John P. Kennedy, wrote that in the early diagnosis of a cold was followed by identifying the symptoms of St. Anthony's fire, also known as erysipelas. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, neither do I.
But he dies in 1834, so I guess he wouldn't be able to run in 1836. Huh. Man, that was a quick downfall there.
Yeah. Go from 7 electoral votes to
colony death. In Florida to death.
Yeah.
In like a year. Wirt's last rites were attended by President Jackson and members of his cabinet. John Quincy Adams read the eulogy in front of the House of Representatives. Wirt was buried in Congressional Cemetery in D.C. Now it gets really weird.
Oh, no.
In the early 2000s, after a series of mysterious phone calls to the cemetery, it was discovered that in the 1970s, someone had broken into his tomb and stolen his skull.
Oh.
After the skull was recovered from the house of a historical memorabilia collector, Robert L. White, it spent time in D.C. council member Jim Graham's office while he tried to get it returned to the crypt.
How would you, like, is it that hard of a process to get a skull back to a crypt?
I don't think so. I think you would just walk to the cemetery and kind of throw it in there, but...
Yeah.
Finally, in 2005, investigators from the Smithsonian Institute were able to determine the skull, which had gold black letters saying Han William Wirt painted on a tin box containing it was indeed it, and had it returned. Once again, I feel like that should not be that long of a process.
Yeah, no, shouldn't have taken like 3 years.
Like, got skull from guy, put it back in cemetery. Like,
yeah, like, I don't know.
Why does someone want his head?
Maybe it was the Masons.
Like no one knows who this guy is. He's not like a major historical figure in American history.
Maybe the Masons got it just to say, like, this is what happens when you go against us.
Robert L. White?
I don't know, maybe.
Is he whatever happened to him? So many questions. Next one. A little farther down the road, 1870, name is Victoria Woodhull. We kind of talked about her in our last episode. She was nominated for President of the United States by the newly formed Equal Rights Party on May 10th, 1872 at Apollo Hall in New York City. A year earlier, she had announced her intention to run. Also in 1871, she publicly spoke out against a government only being composed of men. She proposed the development of a new constitution and the creation of a new government a year after. Her nomination was ratified at the convention on June 6, 1872, making her the first woman candidate. There's a problem, though. Women can't vote or run for office.
That's definitely a roadblock.
That is a roadblock back in 1871, 72. She then picks Frederick Douglass as her vice presidential candidate. Even though he was not at the convention, he had no knowledge of the convention or his nomination and played no active role in the campaign whatsoever.
I think we talked about that.
His nomination, though, stirred up controversy about the mixing of white and black people in public life. And the Equal Rights Party hoped to use the nominations to reunite suffragists with African-American civil rights activists because the exclusion of female suffrage from the 15th Amendment 2 years earlier had caused substantial rift between the two groups.
Yeah.
Having been vilified in the media for support of free love, Woodhull devoted an issue of Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly to an alleged adulterous affair between Elizabeth Tilton and Reverend Henry Ward Beecher. Oh, no. A prominent Protestant minister in New York.
Oh.
He supported female suffrage, but had lectured against free love in his sermon. So basically she thought that like marriage was outdated and just be able to do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Well, Woodhull published the article and said there was a double standard between men and women.
Wait, the free love, wasn't that at the Oneida community?
Yep.
Go listen to our Garfield assassination episode.
I forgot about that guy and no one loved him.
Yeah.
He couldn't find love in the free love commune.
Listen to that episode so you know what we're talking about.
She basically argues that there was a double standard between men and women, which there was at this time, where men could have as many mistresses as they wanted and nothing was ever really frowned upon. But women were not. The same day, a few days before the presidential election, U.S. federal marshals arrested her. Her second husband, Colonel James Blood, and her sister, Tenney, on charges of publishing an obscene newspaper.
Oh, no.
The sisters were held in the Ludlow Street Jail for next month. That kind of sounds, goes against habeas corpus a little bit.
Yeah.
A place normally reserved for civil offenses, but that also held more hardened criminals.
I feel like back then, an obscene newspaper, it was obscene newspaper, right?
Yeah.
That's what it was. I feel like it's just usage of the word darn. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, back then, like...
The arrest was arranged by Anthony Comstock, the self-appointed moral defender of the nation at the time. Oh, that's always a good moniker that you want, the moral defender. Nothing ever goes wrong there. Just look at Iran right now. The three were acquitted on a technicality 6 months later, but the arrest prevented Woodhull from attempting to vote during the 1872 presidential election. With the publication of the scandal, Theodore Tilton, Elizabeth's husband, sued Beecher for alienation of affection. The later trial in 1875 was sensationalized across the nation and eventually resulted in a hung jury. Woodhull received no electoral votes in the election of 1872, an election in which six different candidates received at least one electoral vote.
Man.
A man in Texas did vote for her, though, saying he was casting his vote for her because it was a vote against Grant.
I mean, the Southerners did hate Grant.
They did, so, yep.
Yeah.
Woodhull again tried to gain nominations for the presidency in 1884 and 1892. Newspapers reported that her 1892 attempted culminated in her nomination by the National Women Suffragist Nominating Convention. Marietta L.B. Stowe of California would be her vice presidential candidate. The convention was held at Willard's Hotel in Boonville, New York. Well, that one didn't go well either. And it doesn't help that at the convention, she claimed that she was destined by prophecy to be elected president of the United States.
What prophecy?
It's never a good sign either.
Yeah. It was, didn't Andrew Johnson claim that God killed Abraham Lincoln so he could become president?
That wouldn't shock me.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did.
Wouldn't shock me. All right, last one. Horace Greeley. Kind of talked about him, too.
Yeah, yeah.
As has been the case in much of the 19th century, political parties continued to be formed and vanish after the Civil War. In 1871, Missouri Senator Carl Schurz formed the Liberal Republican Party. Founded on the opposition to President Grant, opposition to corruption, and support of civil service reform, lower taxes, and land reform, he gathered around him an eclectic group of supporters whose only real link was they hated Grant.
Man, a lot of people hate Grant.
They did. He was not very well liked. And he's been, for the most part, ranked as one of the worst presidents of all time.
Yeah. And it's mainly just because of all the corruption like that his cabinet did.
Correct. Yep. And he was kind of just like turned a blind eye to it. The party needed a candidate with a presidential election upcoming. Horace Greeley was one of the best known Americans, as well as being a perennial candidate for office. He was more minded to consider to run for the Republican nomination, fearing the effect on the Tribune should he bolt the party. Nevertheless, he wanted to be president as a Republican, if possible, if not a liberal Republican. The Liberal Republican National Convention met in Cincinnati in May 1872. Greeley was spoken of as a possible candidate, as was Missouri Governor Benjamin Gratz Brown. Schurz was ineligible because he was foreign-born. On the first ballot, former minister to Britain Charles Francis Adams led, but Greeley took a narrow lead. On a revised second ballot, Adams then retook the lead, but on the sixth ballot, after a spontaneous demonstration staged by Reed, Greeley gained a nomination with Brown as the vice presidential candidate. Ronald White wrote, "No one summed up Grimley's strength and weaknesses better than Grant, who wrote, 'A friend, he is a genius without common sense.'" I know people like that.
Yeah.
It's called book smart.
Me.
Not street smart. The Democrats would then meet in Baltimore in July, face a stark choice. Nominate Greeley, long time a thorn in their side, or split the anti-Grant vote and go on to certain defeat. They chose the former and even adopted the liberal Republican platform, which called for equal rights for African Americans. The Democrats? Oh, that's interesting. Back then,
yeah,
you know about politics in the 1870s?
Yeah, a lot of, yeah.
But wait, Reconstruction was still going on though, right?
What year was this?
1872?
Yeah.
Okay.
77 is when it ends.
So that's probably why.
Yeah.
Because the Democratic Party is basically just Northerners at that point that are in the South, correct?
Yeah.
The Carpetbaggers?
Yes.
Is that what they were?
I forgot about that word.
Who were the Scallywags?
I don't remember. I think, I don't remember. We didn't learn about that one.
Greeley resigned as editor of Tribune for the campaign and, unusually for a time, embarked on a speaking tour to bring the message to the people. As it was customary for candidates for major office not to actively campaign. What?
Then how do they... What?
We should go back to that.
Yeah.
I'm all for that. No more stupid commercials. Nevertheless, in late July, Greeley and others, such as former Ohio Governor Rutherford B. Hayes, thought he would very likely be elected. Greeley campaigned on a platform of intersectional reconciliation, arguing that the war was over and the issue of slavery resolved. He asserted that it was time to restore normalcy and end the continuing military occupation of the South. Guess where he's trying to get votes?
The South.
The Republicans counterattacked with well-financed, accusing Greeley of support for everything from treason to the KKK.
Oh, man.
Man, we got those type of attacks occurring in 1872 already?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's where it starts. The anti-Greeley campaign...
It kind of started in, like, 1800, because, like, those... Like, if you read some of, like, the stuff that candidates said about each other in the election of 1800, it's some, like, insane stuff.
Is it?
Yeah.
Check that out. The anti-Greeley campaign was famously and effectively summed up in the cartoons of Thomas Nast, whom Grant later credited with a major role in his reelection. Nast cartoons show Greeley giving bail money for Jefferson Davis, throwing mud on Grant, and shaking hands with John Wilkes Booth across Lincoln's grave.
Oh,
that's some pretty hardcore stuff there. The credit mobilier scandal, corruption in the financing of the Union Pacific Railroad, broke in September, but Greeley was unable to take advantage of Grant administration ties to the scandal, and he had stock in the railroad himself. Well, that's probably why you can't attack Grant, because you made money off of it as well. Some alleged it had been given to him in exchange for favorable coverage. Oh. Greeley's wife, Mary, had returned ill from a trip in Europe in late June. Her condition worsened in October, and he effectively broke off campaign in October 12th to be with her. She died on October 30th, plunging him into despair a week before the election. Poor results for the Democrats in those states that had elections for other offices in September and October basically showed that Greeley was going to be defeated. He received 2,800,000 votes compared to 3.5 million votes to Grant. Grant secured 286 electors compared to 66 by Greeley. He won six states.
Oh, man.
Georgia, Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri, Tennessee, and Texas.
So all Southern states.
Yes.
Yeah.
Greeley resumed editorship of the Tribune quickly, learned that a movement to unseat him was underway. He found himself unable to sleep, and after a final visit to the Tribune on November 13th, he remained under medical care. After the recommendation of family physician, Greeley was sent to Choate House, the asylum of Dr. George Choate of Pleasantville, New York. There he continued to worsen and died on November 29th.
Oh, dang.
His death came before the Electoral College ballot. His 66 electoral votes were divided among four other candidates. Indiana Governor Thomas A. Hendricks, Greeley's vice president, and Greeley's vice presidential running mate Benjamin Gratz Brown. Okay. Although Greeley had requested a simple funeral, his daughters ignored his wishes and arranged a grand affair. He is buried in Brooklyn Greenwood Cemetery. Among the mourners were old friends and President Grant.
Oh.
So, yeah, he dies before the election ends.
That's not good.
No, he wasn't going to win anyway, though.
Yeah.
So, mute point. Boy, those were three of the more interesting candidates we've had in our history.
Yep.
I'm sure we could find more.
Oh, definitely.
But that's all we got time for today. So come back, listen in a couple weeks when we talk about interesting political parties.
Ah, I'm excited for that one.
Yes. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for tuning in to History Class After Hours, the show where we talk about the things your history teachers didn't have time to teach you. If you wanted to stay updated on upcoming events for the History Club, please visit www.starsmillhistoryc.wixsite.com/2020. If you liked this episode, please share it with your friends and subscribe to our channel on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. Be on the lookout for new episodes, and we'll be posting every week. Until next time, stay curious.